அனைத்து அன்னை அன்பர்களுக்கும் எங்கள் இனிய காலை வணக்கங்கள். ஸ்ரீ அன்னை பகவான் ஸ்ரீ அரவிந்தர் தவ திரு கர்மயோகி அவர்களின் பாதார விந்தங்களில் பணிந்து இன்றைய லைஃப் டிவைன் நிகழ்ச்சியை துவங்குகிறோம். இன்று சாப்டர் லைஃப் டிவைன் சாப்டர் 26 அசெண்டிங் சீரீஸ் ஆஃப் சப்ஸ்டன்ஸ். மிஸ்டர் கேரி ஜேக்கப்ஸ் அவர்களும் மிஸ்டர் சந்திரசேகரன் அவர்களும் பேச இருக்கிறார்கள். ஃபர்ஸ்ட் ஐ ஆம் இன்வைட்டிங் மிஸ்டர் கேரி டு தி ஸ்பீச்.
We are getting close to the end of the first book of Life Divine. This is the 26th session, actually more because we had a few sessions that weren't on specific chapters. And in the last three chapters of Book 1, Sri Aurobindo puts all the pieces together to give us a comprehensive perspective. The first eight chapters were an introduction. Then he started with pure existence, Sat, and traced us through Sat, Chit, Ananda, supermind, mind, life, the psychic, the double soul, matter. Now he's going to tell us how it all fits together. Book one is called The Omnipresent Reality in the Universe. Now he has described the omnipresent reality and all the major aspects of the universe, but still we have to see how they all go together. So I thought it would be helpful if we look at what we have heard so far and try to see what is the essence of what he's trying to present to us. Because if we have a framework, then every individual thing he says will fit into that framework. And he has given us all the pieces. He's given us all the pieces. Now we just have to see how they all fit together. Let's not look at this from our point of view. We always look at the world from our point of view. Let's try to look at this from the divine's point of view, which is the supermental point of view. Our point of view is fragmented, divided, partial. The divine's point of view is an integral vision. So how does the divine see us and see the world and see itself? He tells us that the ultimate reality is the absolute. The absolute is not an emptiness. It's a multi-dimensional infinity. It is all that can be conceived and all that's beyond conception. And therefore we can only say that it's infinite. And the attributes of that infinite, well, we can't limit it by any attributes because every attribute is a limitation. But there are some essential secrets to a comprehension of the absolute. And so if we take the words not as limitations but as pointing to the essence, it can help us. He speaks of three. One is, the absolute is a unity. It contains all. He says it's an intensive unity. It contains all multiplicity and yet it is undivided. It's an identity. What do we mean by identity? The absolute is not different than anything else. It's identical with everything. Because everything, including us, ourselves, are only expressions of that absolute. There is nothing other than the absolute. There is nothing that is not identical in its essence with the absolute. And the third secret is freedom. The absolute can be anything, and in fact it is everything, but it's not limited by anything that it has become, anything that it is, or anything that it may be in future. So unity, identity, and freedom can be called not the attributes, but perhaps the secrets for us to delve to the absolute. And then he tells us that this reality is an infinite oneness. When we think of infinite, we think of a large quantity or a large space. It is a oneness, and yet it is at the same time an infinite multiplicity. And he explains, this oneness never ceases to be one, but it's in constant movement. And that movement is a movement from unity to multiplicity and back again. Without ever ceasing to be one, through the involution, it moves from unity to the multiplicity of the universe, and through the evolution, it moves from the multiplicity back to the unity, but it is always one at all times. And so he calls it an infinitely variable oneness. When we think of oneness, we think of sameness. We think of something that's unchanging. This is an infinitely variable oneness that can become anything and everything, but remains one. The tradition talks of Atman, Brahman, Self, conscious being, spirit, divine, God, Ishwara, and has so many names it's enough to confuse anyone. He says, don't be confused by the names. They are all aspects of one reality. They're all partial experiences, or we can say they're all truths of that one reality. It's a wonderful question, and I'm very tempted. But he has a whole chapter on this subject of Brahman, Purusha, Ishwara. It's the second chapter of book 2. It's a very long chapter. It's a very marvelous chapter. Maybe we can spend 3 months on it. So I'm very reluctant to spend 3 minutes on it. And if I answer you, I would say Brahman, Purusha, Ishwara are not so much poises of our consciousness, they're poises of the divine consciousness. The Brahman, when it looks and is absorbed only in itself, it's only aware of itself and doesn't pay attention to the world that it has become, it's Atma. The divine, when it looks and witnesses, observes the world it has created, it's Purusha. The divine, when it takes the poise of being the creator and determinant of everything in the world, and nothing happens other than it, is the Ishwara. In fact, it's capable of all these three poises at the same time. It's not one that's true and one that isn't true. There are experiences of the Brahman in each of these poises, and it's a marvelous topic, which we will But thank you for the question, and I want more questions. He also tells us that what we call transcendence, what we call universal, the cosmos, and what we call individual, are not three different things at all. They're three aspects of this ultimate reality. And he's going to go further and further into what is the relationship between the transcendent, the universal, and the individual. And there we'll get to the key to his yoga. Perhaps the only one, I believe. Because he shows the unique role of the individual in the spiritual evolution of the divine. We are not an accident. We are not just a sideshow. The individual is the key to the whole manifestation and spiritual evolution. Now he tells us in this chapter and in the next chapter, but just for the overview I mentioned here, that Satchitananda Supermind has created the world. That's what he's told us. He's traced it in the chapters on Supermind. He told us that mind is only a subordinate instrument of Supermind. He told us that life is only a subordinate power of chit, of the conscious force. He told us in the last two chapters that matter itself is an expression of the pure existence. And he told us that the psychic, the evolving soul, is an expression of Ananda. So, Satchitananda, supermind above, mind, life, body, and psychic below. That which is above is manifesting below. He told us in the second chapter, first in the first chapter he said that a divine life is not only possible, a divine life is inevitable. He said it. We say it's very nice to be here. But how could he say that? In the second chapter he said, on the materialist denial, he said, divine life would only be possible if matter and spirit are not totally different things. If matter and spirit are totally contradictory things, then a divine life would be a logical impossibility. But he told us there that matter, mind, life, and spirit are only different forms of the same substance. He didn't explain it. He simply stated it in one paragraph. In this chapter, he's going to explain the secret of the relationship between matter, life, mind, and spirit. He already told us in the chapters on matter that matter is Satchitananda. Suddenly we thought we were in matter and now we find we're in Satchitananda. But there's a lot of space in between. That was a big jump to go from one to the other. In this chapter, he's going to fill in all the missing links to show us that matter, life, mind, supermind, Satchitananda, represent an ascending series of substance. They are not opposites. They're different forms of one reality. And we know already that the involution that creates the cosmos and the evolution of the cosmos, these are the grand movements. These are the grand movements of the divine in its play. It doesn't need a manifestation, but it seeks the manifestation for the sheer delight. And its play is a movement of involution and evolution. And how is that evolution taking place? What is driving it? What is determining it? He says two things. From above, there is all the divine that wants to manifest itself. pressing to manifest, pressing to express itself. Like Jane Austen, she's full of her story, she's eager to write it down. Don't interrupt me, I'm busy, I have so much to say. On the other hand, all that the divine wants to manifest is already here, in the creation, buried in the creation, secret, hidden within the creation, wanting to come out, pressing from below to come out, to evolve. Life is buried in matter. Mind is buried in life. Supermind is buried in mind. In fact, he told us already, Satchitananda itself is buried, is hidden in matter, eager to express itself, eager to come to the surface. So, the hidden principles are pressing for emergence from below and from above, leading to manifest the unmanifest. So this gives us an essential framework with which we can understand everything in the book. And most of the difficult concepts in the book, almost all of them have already been presented. What he's going to do in book two, which is much longer, he's going to elaborate and explain many of the details and the secrets. But if we understand these points, then nothing should be difficult for us in the rest of the book. This is looking at life from the supermind's point of view. Now, how about our point of view? Our point of view is what he politely calls ignorance. We start from the other end. We start where all is division. All of us feel separated from everyone else, separated from the world around us, separated from the divine. For us, everything, the whole world consists of millions and millions of separate objects, separate people, separate events, separate places. And we have to go travel all the way back from infinite division to unity and oneness. We have a long way to travel. For us, the infinite and the finite appear to be ultimate contradiction. If there's one thing we're quite sure about is, we're very limited. We're very finite. We have very limited knowledge. We have very limited capacity. We have very limited possessions and power and skills and just about everything. For us, the idea of infinity is a contradiction. To say our life can be infinitely rich, well, if you mean it can be more rich than it is, we can understand more. But infinity is not a term we can understand. He has told us that the finite is only a frontal appearance of the infinite, that there is no real finite. The finite is only the way we see the infinite. So we have a long way to go to come out of that view. For us, God, universe, individual are totally different things. When we pray to God, when we pray to Mother, we are praying to somebody who we think is either very far off or very near, but who's totally different from us. Mother, help me. We never think we're praying to ourselves. We never think that ultimately we are the Ishvara, because it's totally different. We said, everybody's harassing me, the world is giving me so much trouble, or nobody takes any notice of me, I'm all alone in the world. For us, the world is totally separate from we are. We see it totally divided. For us, the spirit, the divine, and the cosmos, in the tradition especially, they're completely separate from one another. The tradition is, let's get out of this ignorance, let's get out of this suffering, or let's get out of this illusion and go to the real place where we should be, which is the Spirit. It's very hard for us to imagine that this is the Spirit, that this is the Divine, that this is the playground and field for the Divine manifestation. For us, the cosmos and our own lives seem to have no purpose. Or if they have a purpose, it's, well, I have to get a job, I have to get married, I have to earn some money, I should have children, I should make people happy, they should make me happy also. Okay, I should be a good person. That's also that. But what is all of this going on? And why are all these people seeking so many different things? And why are we here? If there's any purpose, we have to only take Shrivindo's point view. We have to trust to his judgment because we don't see anything, any purpose in the world around us. We just see a lot of activity. And for most people, if we're materialists, God is an illusion. If we're illusionists, the world is an illusion. One way or the other, either don't delude yourself and think that God is going to save you, or don't delude yourself and think that any of this is real. But of course, he tells us there is no illusion. There may be delusions, but there are no illusions. Everything is real. So we have a long way to travel. So this is our problem. And this is the problem that he faces in talking about creating a divine life. Because the human life in the body seems to be the very opposite of a divine life. So what does he mean by a divine life? The book is called Life Divine. He starts off saying our destiny is life divine. But what is a life divine? What does it mean? Where are we? Where do we have to go? Well, we are unconscious and ignorant. A divine life would be a life where we're fully conscious and we know everything. We know everything, at least anything we want to know, we can know because we have the truth consciousness. The human life, everything is divided. In the divine life, we would know, we would feel oneness with all. Oneness with all others, oneness with the cosmos, oneness with the transcendent. The human life, we're constantly subject to the external forces of life around us. Oh, my parents are giving me trouble. Oh, society, my neighbors are harassing me. My boss is harassing me. The laws have changed. The traffic is heavy and I got delayed. The weather is not proper. Disease is coming. So many things are happening. We're just being pushed here and there, blown away like a leaf in the wind or a feather in the wind. But in the divine life, we'd be all powerful. Nothing. First of all, there's nothing outside of us. There is no other power. There is nothing to determine us. We can be anything we want to be. So quite a distance from where we are today. Human life, we're subject to pain and suffering. Divine life would be a life free from pain, not free from pain, a life of delight. A life that moves from delight to greater delight, joy to greater joy. There would not be anything called suffering or limitation of any kind. And finally, the life we lead is a life where we already know the end of the story. From the time we're born, we know that this is, we know the end, we know the last chapter of this story. The last chapter for this life is death. Death is inevitable. For the divine life, there is no death. There is no end. Of course, he tells us, even for life, and there'll be two chapters on it later, even what we call, he's already told us that what we call death is only a process of life. It's not a real end. But for the body, it's a real end. Not for our life, not for our consciousness, not for our soul. But for the body, it's a real end. So I put all of this together to make it clear how great is the change he's proposing. Let's not minimize the magnitude of the change. Let's not say, well, yes, yes, it's going to get better and better and it'll be very nice and we'll all feel divine. This is completely opposite to what we know. And this is very important for us to keep in mind, because in this chapter, he's going to explain to us, if a divine life is to be possible, it is not possible so long as matter remains as it is. If matter is only what it is and remains unchanged, all these things are not possible. We can never come out of the ignorance. We can never come out of the limitation. We can never come out of suffering. We can never overcome death if matter remains what it is. So you and I may not wake up every morning being very concerned about what is the nature of matter and how to transform it. But for Sri Aurobindo, who feels, who has said that the supramentalization of Earth is coming and coming very soon, this is the ultimate challenge. How are we going to transform matter? And he explains, he's already told us the problem of matter. The problem of matter is division, ignorance, inertia, helplessness. And unless we can overcome those three, there's no divine life. So this chapter is of great practical importance for him in explaining that a divine life is possible. Because the mind, we think we can change our mind, maybe we can change our feelings in life, but matter seems to be something that's unchanging. So we need to understand the obstacle of matter and how and why he says matter can change. So what is the solution to this? We're still in the overview. This is just an overview of the book. We haven't really come to the chapter yet. The solution he gives in a few key steps, he's going to go into great detail in book two. But what is the essence for us? What do we need to know? What do we need to do? The first thing we need to do is we need to go within. Go within. Go inside. We're stuck on the surface. We know the surface is ignorant, the surface is divided, the surface is looking at things through mind, the surface is locked in a moment of time. Without going in from the surface, there is no way to transform life. It's not enough we go to moksha. There we only escape life. We can go from the surface to moksha. We cannot go from the surface to supermind, and we cannot transform life. So the key is, don't be in such a hurry for highest spiritual samadhi and all of that. You have to go in. Why? Because inside, deep inside, at the psychic center, is an integral center of our consciousness. It's the only place in our being where we're connected with everything else, where the individual is connected to the cosmos and we're connected to the transcendent, where we can be in life and have the spiritual experience without losing contact with life. We have to move from the part to the whole. And for us, the psychic, the evolving soul buried in the subliminal is the key for that. So go within from the divided surface to the psychic depths. It's to move from the center of division, that's where we are, where everything's divided, to the center where we see and feel our connectedness with everything else. From there, we can reunite ourselves with the universal. We can discover the soul in every other person, our oneness with all others. We can discover our oneness with the transcendent divine without losing our individual consciousness. Therefore, the psychic is really the key to everything. There, the superconscient above and the subconscient below, the pure light above and the pure darkness below, there they meet. And we can use the light from above to destroy the darkness from below and make the light wider and wider and wider until the whole world is light. This is the meeting place between all that's above us and all that's below us. It's from the psychic that we can release the higher planes of consciousness. We can climb up the stair to higher planes of consciousness to reach the supermind, and we can bring the supermental consciousness down into the lower parts of the being. So psychic is the center of integration. We can invoke the descent of the supermental power to transform our mind, transform our life, transform our physical existence. So this is an overview. We've studied all of the parts. He's told us all of these things, but in different places at different times. Once we get this structure, anything he tells us fits within the overall view. Yes.
Until otherwise, if we go into the psychic field, we cannot go and direct the consciousness. Or rather, we have to transform ourselves and then go to the psychic and then direct the higher level.
To go to the psychic means to move from the ego. It's the ego is a false consciousness which keeps us divided from everybody else. You can move from the ego to moksha. And if you come back, you'll still be in the ego. You'll still be separate. That's why the key goal is here. Get rid of your sense of separation and division. Move from the ego to the psychic. Then transformation begins. We can only start transformation when we get out of the false consciousness. Have I answered your question? Good question. Thank you. So, we've got the synthetic vision. We see it. We know where we started from. We know the solution. We know also the problem. Now, where does matter fit into this whole thing? And why has he spent 2 chapters on matter already? I don't think in any book of spirituality they worry it matters. Something to be given up. Matter is false. Matter is a hopeless case. What are you doing talking about stones and rocks and a physical body? It's all to be overcome. But for him, the whole key is in matter. So what is matter? What is the problem of matter that makes it so opposite to the divine light? He talks about the characteristics of matter. Matter is gross, solid, tangible. It resists change. If I come back tomorrow, I expect the table to look exactly like it does today, and unless somebody touches it, I expect it to be in the same place that it is today. It's fixed. It's rigid. It's unconscious. It's inert. It doesn't act on its own. It can be pushed around, but it's not capable of any initiative of its own. In the Vedas, matter is symbolized by the earth principle. It's the most physical of all physical things. It's the most tangible. For us, it's the most concrete. And for most of us, if we're honest, it's the most real. Matter means it's real. It's real. I can touch it. I can feel it. I can smell it. I can taste it. It's so real I can taste it is a phrase. For us, matter is reality. We have a long way to go. We judge the reality of anything in terms of how concrete it is, whether we can touch it, whether it stays where it is. Anything that doesn't have these gross characteristics is for us, well, I had a nice experience, but it's gone. It doesn't exist anymore. What's real is what's with me, what I can touch. He raises the question, why was matter created? For the scientist, this never arises because matter's everything. There was only matter, there's only will ever be matter. But we start at the other end. Why should the divine create matter, or rather, correctly to say, why should the divine take the form of matter? If matter is unconscious, unchanging, insensitive, divided, what possible purpose can it serve? In the manifestation and evolution of the divine, matter is really the key. Because it's like Jane Austen. Imagine Jane Austen having the whole story of, she wakes up one morning and there's the story of Pride and Prejudice in her head. And her sister comes into the room and says, Jane, what are you doing? I just have this wonderful story in my head. It's so exciting, I'm just lost in wonder of it. What will Jane say? Why don't you write it down? No, no, it's a wonderful story. Write it down. You'll forget it. Anybody who has a story, the first thing she'll do is she'll write it down. Why? Because she wants to make it permanent. Imagine if every day Jane wakes up and has another wonderful story in her head. And then when her sister comes and asks her, what about the yesterday's story? I forget. Gone. The artist has an urge to give form to the creation and inspiration so that it will have permanence, so that it will last, so that it can be seen, it can have a shape. If Jane Austen has never written this story down 200 years ago, some 30 million copies have sold, but how many people have read the story? How many people have enjoyed the story because she took her inspiration and gave it a concrete form that had some permanence to it? Because Shakespeare wrote down 37 plays 500 years ago, we're still able to enjoy, have the knowledge, the inspiration, and the joy that he felt at that time. Why did Shah Jahan build the Taj Mahal? Because he felt such a powerful love. Such a powerful love, he wanted to immortalize it. He knew he would die, she would die. He wanted this love to be remembered. He wanted a symbol. The Taj Mahal is not love. It's a marble building. But it was a symbol. He wanted to immortalize that love in a symbol. And he wanted something that would last. So he built it of stone that could be there for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years as a symbol. So matter is a form to give expression to the formless. And the very characteristics of matter that make it so resistant to change, so unconscious, so unresponsive to our requests, our will, our instruction, or our wishes, is the very thing that makes it last. The very thing that makes it concrete to others, tangible, and lasting. So, matter manifests form as durable image, something that will last. And the divine in creating a universe is not one story of Pride and Prejudice or a million. The divine has an infinite inspiration that he wants to express in the universe as an adventure of consciousness and joy, and make as tangible and concrete to his own experience as possible. And therefore, the building blocks, Jane Austen uses words as the building blocks for her story. The Emperor uses marble as the building blocks for a symbol of love. The divine uses mind, life, and matter as the building blocks of a universe to express the inexpressible inspiration that it has inside. If the divine has only used mind, it would have been very vivid, but it would have been gone. If it only used light, it would have been full of energy, but the forms would have disappeared just like yesterday. It's gone for us. But by bringing it to matter, he makes that manifestation concrete and lasting. But in choosing matter as the building block, he also creates the ultimate problem for himself. Because the matter that we start with is so opposite. He wants to express the truth of spirit in stone. It's like Shah Jahan wanting to express the truths of love in stone. He's not content that we feel an inspiration of love when we see the Taj. The divine wants the Taj itself to be love, to express love, to manifest love, to be conscious instrument and form and vibration of love. For that, matter has to be transformed. Matter has to become conscious. So he tells us in this chapter that there's an ascending series of substance. We have matter at one end, we have spirit at the other. At one end, with matter, we have durability of form. The form remains what it is, unchanging. It lasts for a long time. At the other end, we have spirit, which is eternal, but it's eternal essence, not form. The spirit is formless. In Satchitananda and beyond, there's no form at all, but there's the essence, the pure essence. In matter, matter is impenetrable. If I put this on the table, it stays on the table, it doesn't go into the table. One form of matter doesn't get mixed with the other. If I put my hands together, they remain two separate hands, they don't merge into each other. Each object is impenetrable to the other, solid. Whereas with spirit, everything is interfused with everything else. Everything interchanges with everything else. Everything can absorb or be absorbed by everything else. Everything is united with everything else. I can put these two together. I can put my hands together. I can never unite them. I can never make them one. For spirit, everything is one. For matter, separation is persistent. her spirit, unity is persistent. Indivisibility, inseparable oneness is there. Now, in between these two poles, these two apparently opposite poles, he says there's an ascending series of substance. Even in material plane, this, what we call matter, is not the only form. This is only the grossest form of matter. But even in material things, we know that there are forms of matter that are more subtle than this. Yesterday it says in the U.S. there was a hailstorm. You know what hail is? It's ice. The size of a baseball, which is the size of the fist. I'm not able to imagine dropping down balls of ice coming, raining down. I've never heard of anything. But what is ice? Ice is concrete. Ice is intangible. Ice is like this object. Now, if we hadn't known, or if somebody doesn't know, and I say, this is a block of ice, what I have here in this container is water. What's the difference between them? This object retains its shape. This object takes any shape of any container. It can flow. If I mix it, I can mix it with other water or with anything else. And it completely mixes with other things. Of course, if I mix it with oil, the oil will stay separate. But it interacts with other things. If I put salt in it, the salt will dissolve. And what happens if I heat this water on the stove? What does it mean? Where does it go? Evaporation. But what happens? It disappears. It changes its nature. It changes into vapor. What is vapor? Compare the water and the ice with the vapor. The vapor has no shape at all. It's not that it takes the shape. It has no shape. It has no, we can see the water. The vapor is formless. But it's real. It's very real. If this bottle had been in the fridge and I put it out here, after a while you'll see water coming on the outside. Why? Because when the air gets in contact with the cold bottle, the vapor that's in the air will come and collect. It's not the water from inside coming on the outside. It's the water that's hidden in the air coming on the outside of the bottle. So what does it mean? Ice, water, and vapor are not three different things. It's one substance. They're chemically absolutely identical. They're three different forms of the same substance. And they look to be so different that vapor looks like spirit to us. You can't see it, and if you tell people there's water in the air, they'll say, what nonsense are you talking about? I know water when I see it. Or there's ice in the air. The air is full of ice. You're crazy. But we know the air is full of water. We couldn't breathe and live without it. If you try to go to a very high place where there's no water in the air, very difficult to breathe. So these are three forms of the same substance. Like that, matter and spirit are two extreme ends of this ascending series of substance. Vapor is still physical. Water is still physical. It's still material. But even there, it's already moving towards from the rigid gross to the subtle. And according to science, when you get beyond the vapor, there's nothing. It's empty. But he says, there's an, the ladder of ascending substance doesn't end with vapor or ether. It keeps going on, and there are many, many planes. It may be hard for us to imagine what those planes are, but we live in them. We have experience of them all the time. And through our experience, we can understand what the ascending series of substance is about. But first, let's ask ourselves, what is substance? What do we mean by substance? If we say matter is substance, and ice is substance, and vapor and water are substance, and spirit is substance, what is substance? Well, he's already told us this. He told us in the chapter on matter. When the conscious being, that is chit, when the conscious being wants to experience itself as an object, it experiences itself as substance. When Satchitananda sits in meditation, which I don't think is a proper way to say it, but anyway, when Satchitananda contemplates itself, it has awareness of itself, it feels ananda. What is it conscious of? It's conscious of ananda. But when Satchitananda wants to become a universe, wants to manifest itself as a universe, it needs to become an object to its own experience. And according to the consciousness that it has, it experiences itself as a substance. In supermind, Satchitananda experiences itself as a supramental substance. It takes form, but it knows that these are all forms of spirit. In matter, he tells us, what we call matter is only Satchitananda. Satchitananda appearing to itself as substance. And he has explained to us that because we view Satchitananda through our mind and our physical senses, it appears to us as matter. It's a very hard thought. We have spent already one full session on it, but it easily goes out of the mind. What we see depends on the consciousness with which we experience it. When Sri Aurobindo was in Alipur jail, he had a supermental vision. What was that vision? He saw, that's a way to say it, but he really, yes, he did. He saw everyone as Narayana. He saw everything as form of spirit. He saw the jailer, the criminals, the judge, the prosecutor, the bars of the jail, the tree. He saw each of them as form of spirit. It doesn't mean that the tree disappeared or the jailer disappeared. He saw the jailer, but he saw the jailer is only form of spirit. He had the supramental vision. He saw that what the jailer is really, the iron bars of the jail, which are iron, what there really is, it's a form of Satchitananda, which appears to the normal vision, our vision, as iron, but appears to the supramental vision as only a form of spirit. So, what we call the physical world and the material objects are only the way, a particular way in which we are experiencing Satchitananda. A particular formula by which Satchitananda presents itself to us, to our consciousness, and we see it as matter. And he tells us that mind and life are only different ways in which we experience Satchidananda. They too have a substance. They too have a consciousness. Well, if you say, or he says, that life and matter are two different forms of substance, it sounds like night and day. What is life? How do I experience matter? I experience it through touch or the physical senses. How do you experience life? Energy. How do you experience energy? The force. How do you experience force? How do you experience it? Study. How do you know that there's a force? Huh? Dynamic changes. Okay, supposing my eyes are closed, can I still experience energy? No? Then you say energy is only something I can see.
Energy moves in a direction which...
Do you sometimes feel very energetic?
Yes.
Do you have to look in the mirror to know that you're energetic? How do you know you're energetic?
The energy is
flexible,
there is no limitation for energy,
it goes
everywhere.
How do you know?
By the sensation.
By the sensation. Can you see energy?
No.
Can you touch energy?
No.
Can you smell energy?
No.
Can you taste energy?
No.
Can you hear energy?
No.
Then how do you sense it?
By
feeling it. Which senses are those? I thought we only had 5 senses.
By the mind.
So you're saying there is a sense by which we can feel energy. When you're happy, you know that you're happy. When you're angry, you know that you're angry. Nobody can talk you out of it. Nobody can say, I don't see anger, I don't want you to show it to me. No. You know, because you have a sense. It's not the physical senses. We have vital senses. We have not only physical senses that can see material things, we have vital senses that can sense life forces, vital energy. And when we use our vital senses, we experience Satchidananda in energy of life and movement of life. So, life is also a substance, but it's not the substance like the ice or the brick or the stone. Life is more of a substance like the water. It's constantly in movement. We can feel the movement of it like a rushing river. We know as it flows, and after it flows, it's gone. When it stops, we don't experience it anymore. But that flow is a substance. If there were no substance, we wouldn't feel it. We wouldn't sense it. There would be nothing to sense. It's a subtle substance. Yes? It's a very, very good question. The question is, for those who couldn't hear it, is, does it mean that matter, life, and mind are the same? Can you remember your question for another 15 minutes? Maybe difficult. Because I will come back to it. If I don't answer it, somebody will remember it. The answer is, matter, life, and mind are not 3 different things. This contains life, this contains mind, this contains Satchidananda. We can experience the material form of it with our physical senses. If it's a living person, we can feel the energy of that person. not with our physical senses. Of course, you can see if they're moving, you can see if they're animated, but that's not the energy. We feel the emotion. When I'm with that person, I feel happy. It's not with the physical senses that you feel the happiness. Or that person is very peaceful. It's not the physical senses. There are subtle senses by which we can feel things. Elizabeth made the mistake of thinking that man Wickham is so handsome, he must be a good man. And very foolish. You can't see goodness with the eyes. You can't feel goodness with the hand. If there is a sense that can sense goodness, obviously she didn't have it. That's a psychic sense, not a physical sense. She made a mistake of judging and thinking she could tell the subtle sense. Whether good Wickham is a good man or a bad man, that's true. He has that attribute, whether he's happy or sad, whether he's energetic or not energetic. You remember when Darcy saw Elizabeth the first time, he said she's tolerable. He's looking at her with the physical senses. Next time he saw her, he's admiring her fine eyes. Not the eyes. Carolyn didn't see anything special about her eyes. He saw there's an energy in her eyes. There's a light in her eyes. There's intelligence in her eyes. There's a quick wit in her eyes. You don't see that with the physical eyes. Nobody else saw it. He saw it with his mental sense. Later on, he saw the courage in her, the strength in her, the goodness of her affection for Jay. With what? With her emotional sense. Finally, he came to realize this is the soul mate that I have been longing for. This is the person I can worship, without whom I cannot live. With the deepest psychic sense in himself, he felt the oneness with her. Which is she? Is she a body? Is she a personality? Is she a mind? Is she a soul? She's all of them. It's not their separate things. They are different bodies, different layers of substance, all within each other. See, out of the mud, living plants have come. How did the living plants come out of the mud? Where did the life come from? It didn't come from outer space. The life is there in the mud and in the matter, hidden in a different plane. It's not hidden in the atom. It's not hidden in the small particles of sand. It's concealed in a subtle plane. Out of life, out of the animal, mental human being has come. Thinking human being has come. Where did our mind come from? It's buried there in matter. It's buried there in life. It's concealed. Like that, supermind is buried. Satchitananda is buried. Everything is buried within. So the question is, how can we know not just the form of Wickham, but whether he's really a good man or not? How can we know whether Lizzie is just a tolerable-looking girl or a wonderful individual, a spiritual individual? We need a different consciousness. We need to use a different sense in order to do that. So, it comes to a very important point. I put it up there as the second to last point. As is our consciousness, so will be what we perceive. Only when I have the right consciousness will I be able to see the secrets of the hidden substance. We'll see. If we have the right consciousness, we'll see the soul in everyone. It doesn't mean that there's nothing else to see. We will know that whatever we see, Wickham is a handsome person, but there's something more there. Lizzie may be only physically tolerable, but there's something more there. If we have the consciousness, we will see the deeper truths, and we will judge everything according to the deepest truths. Mother said even the asuras, the four asuras, are her children. And they also have a role to play, a divine role to play in the universe. So, we were talking about life, and we said, life is a plane. It has its own consciousness, it has its own substance. We don't sense that substance with our physical senses, we sense it with our subtle, our vital senses. What about thought? What about mind? When you have a thought and say, I have a thought, sir, how do you have a thought? How do you know you have a thought? I don't see your thought. No, I have this thought, it's pressing. How do you know? What do you see your thought with? If Sri Aurobindo gives us an idea, we receive the idea. What do we receive it with? Not with our hand. Not just with our ears, because you can hear the sound, but not the idea. We receive the idea with our mental sense. We perceive thoughts with our sense. Some of us we perceive a thought as words. Some people see as an image. When you think of a person, you may think of their name. You may actually see the image of the person. What is that image made of? What is that image? If there's an image, it must be made of something. If it's not made of marble, it must be made of something else. What is it made of? It's made of mental substance. Now, what's the difference between mental substance and the physical substance? The mental substance is like vapor. The life substance is like the water. The physical substance is like the ice. These can change very rapidly. It's here. I had that thought, then I lost it. How often we lose the thought. We can't hold on for a second. It's like a cloud. You try to grab it and it disappears. But it has a form. If it didn't have a form, we couldn't understand the thought. We couldn't think of the thought. I say combine two thoughts together and make something else out of it. We couldn't do that. If it wasn't something, it is something. It's a subtle substance. Then he tells us a very important thing. There are an infinite grades of substance, from the grossest material thing at one end to the most subtle, which is pure spirit, at the other. We don't know all of these, and he says that's an occult subject. We're not going into it now. But we at least can understand there are these gradations. And one very important thing he tells us about this substance. The more subtle the substance is, the more powerful it is. Now this is contrary to our normal conception because we think what's concrete is real. Mrs. Bennett has a vital substance which we can call aspiration. How powerful it is? It brings Bingley to Meryton, it brings Darcy to Meryton, it brings Collins to Meryton, it brings Wickham to Meryton. If that's not power, I don't know what is. I don't think there's any physical thing that can make all of these people come. Darcy has an aspiration for Elizabeth. Elizabeth decides she wants to be mistress of Pemberley. Darcy comes the next moment. It's very powerful. Sri Aurobindo said he had a dream India should be free. India became free on his own birthday. He says, a yogi meditating in the Himalayas dreams of freedom and the French Revolution frees the people of Europe. He didn't tell us that that was he was the yogi who was having that dream. So ideas are powerful. Aspirations are powerful. And every devotee knows how powerful a prayer is. To change a reality, to cure a disease that no medicine can cure, to change a law, to change a procedure, to change your spouse's mind, which may be